Hi there, my name is John Paul Kermy. I am a breathwork teacher. I train people on how to teach breathwork as well. I'm really excited to be doing this new podcast with my good friend Feldy called Hang Ups, where we're going to help you change your life. We're going to show you how to transform your life with different tools.
That's right. I'm John Feldman. I'm in a band called Goldfinger. John Paul taught me breathwork. It changed my life. I have struggled with anxiety and depression throughout my life, and I've gotten through it. This is a solution-based show. We're talking about solutions to problems today.
Good songs, like so many just amazing songs. And they just...
Yeah, they were like the first like band I got into. I guess them and Queen. Like those are the best two classic rock bands.
But they're both so fucking talented. It's not just like guys playing. I mean, the level of like the talent in those bands is unreal, right?
Yeah, Townsend's had some ups and downs in his life, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. How you doing? You good? Did you save your coffee for this podcast, your coffee time?
I got my coffee time right here, buddy.
I'm having a Mexi-Coke.
I love the real sugar yeah. Coke. Did I tell you what my son's doing, talking about the Grateful Dead? My son has been...
What?
When we scan like all the Sirius XM stations, we got to the Grateful Dead station, and I'm like, no! And I'm like, he heard me like freak out. So he went back to the Grateful Dead station, hit favorites, hit like, and then wouldn't let me touch, because I'm driving, he wouldn't let me touch the stereo. And he's searching on my car for Grateful Dead. And he likes every single Grateful Dead song that comes up. He liked about 45, 50 of them. So every time I go in my car, it thinks that that's what I want to hear. So it just automatically plays the fucking Grateful Dead. And what's the other song? There's another song that was played in this restaurant. It was the longest note held in the history of music at the time in like the 70s. It's like, it's a great day. Do you know this song I'm talking about?
Is it? No. But do you know what the longest song is in his music history? It's The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
What is that?
It's by Gordon Lightfoot. It's just a song that's like 28 minutes long. It's about a boat.
How do you know that? How do you know this information?
I don't know. I have a ton of useless fucking information in my head. I mean, I've been a music fan since I was a kid. I hung out with all musicians. I had long hair. That was my world growing up. I played guitar a little bit, but I never dove deep into it. I should have. Should have become a singer, but that's a whole other story. But
Gordon Lightfoot.
I think the new Dylan album, though, that came out, he has that number one hit with his new thing. And I think that might beat it now. I think that's like 40 minutes long. I tried to listen to it. I got 4 minutes in and I was like, I'm not having this. How can this be number one? Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm watching YouTube shit. I'm making fucking pizza dough. That's what I'm doing now. I watched like 4 episodes of pizza dough last night and then I passed out at 8:30 at night. And I got up at like 6 this morning. So I had a lot of sleep.
That's good great, night. Man. I woke up at 8. I couldn't believe it. I slept for 8 hours, which is, I think, a world record for me.
I slept for 9.5. That is for sure the world record for me. I usually get 5 or 6 hours sleep. I usually go to bed at 10 and get up at 4. So
yeah, my kids are sleeping like 12 hours. I've only seen them like, I don't know, 2 minutes today. I went in there. I made them pancakes. I gave them their pancakes and they're just in school doing their school thing. And they don't want any of their kids to see, any of the classmates to see me. So I walk in with the pancakes and they're like, Dad, get out. I want to go in there like naked and just be like, what the fuck, man?
So they have a punk rock star dad and they don't want their friends to see their punk rock star dad on their school Zoom.
No. Hey, Alex, how you doing, buddy?
What's up? How are you guys?
Hey, Alex.
We're great. Is it okay if we record from here on out?
Yeah. I've done a couple podcasts now and it's like, I'm learning the things you're supposed to do.
I love it, dude. So John Paul taught me breathwork meditation, and he's come out on the road with Goldfinger a bunch as sort of like tour manager / sober buddy or whatever.
Personal trainer back in those days. Remember, amazing. We were boxing and doing all that kind of stuff. And then I found this breathwork technique about 8 years ago that changed my life. And
wow.
It changed me as a person. And then people were like, what are you doing? You're like, you're not as angry. So I started showing people, and I taught Feldy the technique, and it's like this, you know, thing you lay on the floor and you breathe in a certain way, and it clears out all the anger and all the stress and all the anxiety out of your nervous system.
That's incredible.
When you tell people that, like, they're like, they can't wrap their brain around it. Cause it's like, well, I've been breathing my whole life. How is this thing? I'm going to lay on the floor and breathe in a certain way. And it's going to do all that. Right.
Right.
Until they do it, they don't get it. But I was doing some research on you and I found this really cool quote, and I was like, that's rad. And it says, breathe, remember it's just chemicals. And you're talking about anxiety and panic attacks.
Yes. Yes.
Go ahead.
I would say that came from a place of it's sort of something I was telling myself in the moment. I think social media has always sort of been a sounding board for me, you know, and I think over time, as I've learned the ins and outs of social media, and as it's evolved over time, you know, I choose more wisely when I put some of those things out there and how I put them out there. But I think that was a pretty raw moment where it was an actual, like, I was feeling pretty vulnerable, and I think I was struggling with some anxiety and whatnot at the time. And it was kind of something that I sort of inwardly told myself in that moment of to try and help kind of talk myself down a little bit. And then I thought that just that quick sort of sentiment was simple enough to be easily absorbed, you know, and I just kind of like put it out there into the world with hope that maybe it would, a few people might find some catharsis in it. So.
I think it's amazing because, you know, I tell people all the time that you have a breathing pattern when you start to feel anxiety, or you have a breathing pattern when you feel depressed, or any of these raw emotions. When you feel angry, you have a breathing pattern. If you can change your breathing pattern, you can change the emotion. And if you can change the emotion, you can start to change your life. And I think you getting raw and real, and like one of the themes of this podcast and the reason Feldy and I wanted to do it was to help people, you know, to show people, like, look, we all struggle. We all struggle with anxiety or depression or anger or whatever. And here's what we're doing to deal with it. Like, and that's the human experience. And how do you handle it? Right, Feldy?
Hey, Alex, have you ever done, I just have a story about John Paul, but have you ever done one of those back in the day when they threw you on these festivals when you're opening for like the Exploited or Megadeth? Have you ever had to do those kind of European?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We have done a good handful of shows like that. I have two like very distinct memories. There was one, I think it was maybe Disturbed was one of the headliners, and Korn. It was awesome. The show was rad, but I mean, we had really no place being on that main stage. And I think we played at like, is it okay time slot, like 3:40 or 4 o'clock, something like that. Like, people were showing up, people were into it. We had a big crowd, but we came out and started playing our, like, you know, happy, jumpy, fast punk rock music, and people were like, what in the world? And we're like it's like Sweden or somewhere where everybody wanted like some chuggy, heavy, you know, riffy music. And we ended up having a great time. I think by the end of it, we actually had the crowd like sort of responding well to us. So that one didn't go so bad. We didn't get bottled, fortunately. But there was another one where it was a very similar kind of festival, and for whatever reason, our booking agent put us on it, and our time slot was 1:30 a.m. or 2:30 a.m. or something like that. It was insane. And I think it was like one of those ones that gets peppered into sort of like fill a day, so you're not breaking the bank with your tour bus in Europe and stuff. And we, you know, we showed up and we did it, but it was like, you know how those festivals are. You park in the middle of a field in the middle of nowhere and you sit all day in the heat. And so after a full day of doing that and then being asked to like, all right, set up, go play. It's 3 a.m. We were like, there were maybe 4 people watching in the tent. It was so like, that was a serious, like, very humbling experience. Cause I believe we had just come from doing like, we'd had a really sick, like, time slot on, Reading and Leeds Fest in the UK, you know, played for 50,000 people. And then a few days later we were 3 a.m. in a tent playing for 5 or 6 people. And it was like, oh, that's a different vibe altogether.
But hey, it keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, we had to do, I was talking to John Paul last week, and we were talking about the show that we had to play in Switzerland opening for the Misfits.
Oh, don't talk about where I beat up that guy.
Yeah, right when we got back from, like, it was like right when they got their reunion thing back, and we played it like 1 a.m. and they played at 3. It was one of those fucking festivals. So people were in the sun all day, like you just talked about.
Yep.
Super wasted, you know, and people in Europe, like festivals in Europe are so different than in the States, man. It's like people take their drinking so serious. Like I remember seeing a dude once passed out at the Reading Festival. He had duct taped a 12 pack of beer around his leg because he knew he was going to pass out and he didn't want anyone to take it. So I just saw this dude passed out on the floor with a 12 pack taped to his fucking leg.
He had a moment of clarity.
And
what I want to ask you, Alex, is I was thinking about just touring a lot because none of us can tour right now because of Corona. Have you had to cancel tours?
We were supposed to go out with the 5 Seconds Boys this month in Europe. Obviously, that's I don't know if the official word is out yet, but we can break the news here. I mean, it's not happening. We're still waiting to hear about our summer tour. We have a summer festival booked. Officially, nothing has been changed yet, but again, it's so fluid and everything is shifting at all times. So I don't know. I mean, I really don't know, but it's looking more and more like the year is going to be pretty heavily affected by this. So yeah, I mean, like you said, we're sort of all in a very strange spot as touring artists. Yeah.
But I was thinking like when I would get off a tour, like I go on the road and every night people are just, it's, you know, it's the best. I mean, part of it's the best, part of it's the worst, whatever. But like the idea of playing shows, all that energy that I absorb in me, and I've seen you guys play a bunch, like what, I wanted to ask you what's your transitional like routine? Because when I come back home, like I get this depression, and this is just me, I just get this depression, and I love being home and I love my family, but it's such a different energy when my kids are like, I don't want a Starbucks this morning before school, Dad. And I'm like,
it's like, different to 20,000 people cheering you on and then somebody screaming at you for a popsicle. It's a very different vibe. Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, I've spoken to this a few times recently. I've definitely hit that sort of post-tour wall, so to speak, when you kind of spend years of your life doing this, and it's kind of, you're in this constant up and down of having an adrenaline rush every night, having this on stage interaction with people, and then all of that goes away like that, you know, snap of a finger. And it's like you said, you know, you're so excited to be home and you're so stoked to be back in your normal family life, seeing friends, catching up. But there's absolutely these moments where you feel these very low lows because it's, your body gets used to that rush every night, whatever it may be. And you kind of, yeah, you slip into a bit of an odd space where you don't have that kind of release. And so I personally have had to find other things to sort of channel that pent up energy into, whether it's exercising or getting into a different activity, just going outside, having a routine, having a schedule to kind of like align with. Because I find personally that when I have no schedule, you know, when you're on tour, you have a day sheet and it tells you where to go, what to do, and where you need to be. And then not having that is just bizarre. It leaves you with this sort of sense of emptiness and an unfulfilling space to be in. And so, yeah, you do have to kind of navigate that really carefully. And the depression is another big part of it. I mean, I've certainly sort of slipped into feeling almost very like ungrateful because I'm home, I'm with my wife, I'm so happy to be here. Why am I sad? You know what I mean? Why do I feel down? Mark from Blink-182 got together and did a project last year called Simple Creatures. And in that music, we sort of wrote and explored a lot of those topics because him and I were sort of going through similar things at the same time. We both just had great record cycles. I think he had just come off the California cycle that you guys did together, and they had like an amazing, amazing 2 years of touring and Grammy noms and whatever. But then we both discussed the same kind of thing, that like we got home and hit this wall of weirdness. And that project was a way for us to kind of navigate through those thoughts and feelings together.
Such a good record, man. Holy shit. That record is so fucking good. Oh, yeah. You guys killed it.
Oh, I thought you meant California, but thank you. Thank you so much.
No, it's Little Creatures, man.
Oh, thank you, dude.
Yeah, and I follow both of you guys, so I see all the fan art and all, like, just all of it, man. The bobbleheads, the whole thing. It's just it's like, funny, it's such man. People really, and I saw you guys, I've seen you guys play twice, man. It's such a cool thing, just the two of you on stage. It's like, it's very, like, I grew up on 80s new wave, and there's definitely, like, I hear a lot of that in the music. It's fucking amazing.
Thank you so much. It was fun to do, and it's going to continue to be fun to do once we can get back into it and make some more songs.
Alexander, I'm curious, in that routine, like what you said, exercise, is there a specific type of exercise that you like to do, or do you do any like meditation or anything, like do you do anything like that? Anything you're into?
I have not explored meditation very much, if at all. I you know, bike riding, running. I ride horses. My wife and I recently bought a farm in Maryland, which is where we live, and we both grew up riding, and it's always been something we've really loved and are now able to kind of get back into it. So we both have horses here on property, and that's like an amazing sort of vent to sort of channel some positive energy into, because it's like, A, it's physically really challenging, and B, you sort of have this weird like psychic connection with this 1,000-pound creature that
they've made a
on.
Therapy out of that. It's called equine therapy, right? They're doing it at all the rehabs in Malibu now. It's really big. Equine therapy, where they connect the people with horses. There's something really special and unique going on there.
They're super interesting, peaceful creatures, and they do, like, once you kind of bond with them, they have a very very good vibe. There's a very cool back and forth that starts to happen.
I dig it. Yeah, I think that's super cool.
I do this thing in my program of, you know, not drinking, is we sometimes list our fears, and one of my fears is horses, man. Their fucking teeth, they're so square. I just think they're just gonna chomp. Like when I was a kid, my mom's like, just hold the apple in your hand flat, because if you hold it like this, they're gonna eat your fingers. And ever since then, I'm like, fuck horses, man.
Oh, sorry. I was just gonna say, I've ridden a few times, and like I rode in Utah in the canyons, and it was amazed at how these things can stay. Like, it was like sideways on the canyon on the rock, and I was going, oh my god, my bike shaking, so nervous. But the horse was just handled it like a boss. I was amazed by it, and I've ridden in Mexico and a couple other places. I find it to be, you know, powerful. It's pretty cool.
It is cool. I think the biggest takeaway for me is always, A, I just feel so good, like, getting out there and doing something. You're in nature, and you're like, we ride out a lot, so the trails around here are super fun. And but the other part of it is just, yeah, like this thing, this 1,000-pound creature that could crush you if it wanted to, like, to have that sort of like trust, that level of trust, there's something very rewarding about that. But I was going to say, John, to your point, my horse does this thing where if you do try to give him a snack, he will never bite you, but his lips, he will put his entire lips like around your hand. So it's, yeah. It's like every single person that goes to feed him is always like, he's going to eat my entire arm. I'm like, he's fine. He won't do it. But yeah, it's weird.
It is trippy that there is some kind of psychic connection. When I say psychic, not you don't read their minds, but there is a connection that you're having with this animal, right? Because otherwise, how does it know where you want it to fucking go? I mean, I guess you could steer it with your feet and your hands, but there is a like, some sort of communication that's going on there that's nonverbal.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of body language, they read your weight, but they truly, like dogs too. Like if you're excitable and weird around dogs, the dog's going to read that vibe. They're very similar. I mean, if you're riding and you're nervous about something, that horse is immediately nervous. They pick up on all that. They have a very incredible intuition. There is absolutely a connection there. I think when I was learning to ride very early on, it was always taught to me, like, even when I didn't know how to steer or do anything with my legs or whatever, one of the first lessons I was ever taught was like, always look where you want to be going. And because it's like, I think your body language in general just kind of navigates a little bit, which is always interesting.
Have you been thrown before?
Not in recent years. And I don't, now that I'm 32, I don't want to be thrown. When I was younger riding, I fell off a few times and was okay, but I don't know how okay I would be now. So the goal is to not fall.
I was just out surfing in San Simeon, and it's really sharky up there. It's cold, tons of seals, a lot of kelp. And the last time I was up there, this woman got her arm bit off by a shark in Cayugas. So it's definitely like sharky shark. But I'm never like, I'm out there, I'm like, whatever. I mean, if this is how I'm supposed to go, I guess I probably wouldn't even notice it. You'd probably go in shock so quickly, you know, if a shark attacked me. But like, for some reason, horses and raccoons, I'm like, nope. Sharks, I'm okay with.
I used to be cool with raccoons, but then when we moved out to LA, actually, one attacked my dog. So I'm used to the raccoons on the East Coast where they want nothing to do with anybody. If you see one remotely close there, it's probably rabid. So it's like, that's how I grew up and that's what I've always been taught. Usually they will leave you alone. They'll run away. In LA, these motherfuckers are like, they'll steal your lunch money. They don't care. Like, they'll sit on your trash cans rooting through it, and you go out, you tell them to leave, and you get two middle fingers. Like, and so I was letting my dog out one night, and he runs to the end of the yard, and I'm like, oh God, what's this? And this raccoon, I guess it was a mom, and it had babies up in the tree, and she just came out and like latched onto his face. And also, you know, my dog gets free and runs away, and then this thing squares up at me for a second. Rather, I'm just like, go back up the tree. I don't want to deal with this.
Yeah, every time we watch Elf, every time that scene, do you need a hug? I'm like, that's the best scene of any movie, all time. Like, I can just rewind it and watch it over and over and over. So JP, the first time I saw All Time Low was, I think it was at the O2 Academy in London. Must have been 10 years ago, you think?
Oh yeah.
Dirty Work, was that what you were touring on, I think, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that, yeah, 8 or 9 years, that would be.
Yeah, and I was just, you know, I've always played shows in Southern California, playing shows with like Pennywise and Bad. Our first tour was with Bad Religion and then Sex Pistols. And it was like, I was so amazed when I saw you. And I was like, you guys played Heroes that night and I was so stoked. You're like, John Feldman's back over there. I was like, yes, yeah, I've made it. I'm in London. It was a really great moment. But like what I noticed, like it was the first time I went to like a punk show. There was like the audience was like split. It was like half girls and half boys. And I was like, why is all my shows all a bunch of bros, you know, sunburned Huntington Beach bros, which I'm very grateful for. Thank you very much.
right.
Very grateful.
They're like, what the fuck, man?
But why, you know, like, what do you think? I mean, besides your obviously, you know, handsome, beautiful face and your amazing voice, what do you think it is?
You know, I really can't put a finger on it, to be honest. I've never thought about it too hard. I've always been, whoever wants to listen, I'm happy to have them come and listen and come to the shows. You know, it's like, if we have any fans at all, I'm stoked. Whatever the ratio is, I rarely pay attention to it. But I don't know. I guess I've never really tried to sit down and quantify what has drawn people to us and why. The big thing I've always picked up on is that there's a lot of people in our audiences who are just there to be a part of a positive community, a girl, a boy, or, you know, anywhere in between. I have always found that there's a sense of like wanting to belong at our shows. And I think that we unintentionally at first were just able to create a really cool, safe environment for people to come and like forget about everything that was going on outside for a minute. And I think that that has been a sort of, that's the universal message we've always gotten from our fans, is that they're like, they're there to come and just forget for a little bit and just like rip it with some friends, friends you don't know, but like everybody in this room is all there for the same reason. So that was sort of a roundabout answer, and I didn't really answer the question, but I don't know. I don't really know.
You know, I think just like from an outsider's perspective, like there's these waves of like, it started super just not like with the Clash and the Sex Pistols, like political and just, you know, gnarly. I mean, it was like, you see photos of people shaving one eyebrow and just hair on one side, you know, the kind of gutter punks of the 70s. And then it kind of moved into Green Day and, you know, I guess Green Day No Effects Land, which was still like pretty aggressive. And I guess comedy came in, but you know, when I think about Blink and you guys, Good Charlotte, you know, I guess the songs became more, you know, the hooks just became so big. And a lot of, you know, I guess your music just speaks to such a wide audience because you're such a fucking prolific songwriter. Thanks, and your voice is just incredible. And I guess that's part of it.
Molded by people like you and you. So thank you for getting me where I am now. But yeah, I think one of the things with All Time Low is that we've always been very melodic. We've always tried to have big, catchy choruses. And I think, you know, that's, like you said, I think at a certain point, punk rock kind of shifted in a certain way. And it was like, it wasn't about fast, loud, rebellious, anti. It was at least when we sort of started getting influenced by the bands we were influenced by, there was a lot of pop sensibility in what was happening. And so I've always looked at us as like a pop rock band. I've never, like, people have labeled us punk, pop rock, whatever. I've always adopted my two favorite things into what we do. And that's fast, loud music with guitars and really, really catchy pop, like in sync, you know, melodies. That's the two things that I love. Like, I love Michael Jackson, Madonna. I've always wanted to sort of marry that into playing loud and fast, which is what we grew up doing, you know, emulating Goldfinger, Blink, NoFX, all the bands that we loved on those Punkorama CDs and the Tony Hawk soundtracks and shit.
Dude, it's so classic how that's come around full circle, man. It's wild. Like, Tony Hawk just made a movie called Pretending I'm a Superman, which is like,
yeah,
I guess I've got to be honored that he called his movie after my song.
So sick. So sick.
It is pretty fucking rad. Yeah, I was just thinking about my sort of, when I tour now, my daily routine has really shifted since when I first started touring when I was like 22 versus now that I'm 52. It's just like, I have to do things now that I never had to do. You know, when I wake up, like, I have to stretch before shows, or the next day, like, my bangover is like so brutal. My neck, you know, that feeling you get where you have to crack it, but it never, you can't even move it because it's so like brutalized. It's like, I have to stretch, and my diet on the road has to be so pristine. Like, I don't know about you, but like, these days I wake up, I'm like cold shower because my whole body is, I mean, I'm much older than you, so maybe I probably have to do more things, but it's like, I don't know. Like, real, what are you doing? What are you doing for that daily routine shit?
It's very real. I mean, I think back to the days that we were touring in a van and driving ourselves around the country and stopping at truck stops with like splitting, I don't know, the $50 that we had left over after we filled the tank from the show the night before, and just grabbing as much shitty food as we could. It was like, it's disgusting, like what we used to live on. And we felt fine doing it. It was like, you would heat up like a cup of noodle, which is just a bag of salt. No offense, because I still love them to this day, but they are like horrible for you. And yeah, like McDonald's, and just filling our bodies with absolute trash, but still somehow managing to get up on stage every night. And I guess we were sweating it out at the time. But yeah, I mean, like, we're all pretty good on the road. We don't require much. Like, it's we try to stay pretty healthy. Water, coffee, and a little bit of booze. We're all still drinkers. So we enjoy some wine on the road. But like, there's a thing that changes in us. And now it's like, the party is not quite the same party that it was 10 years ago. We do it with getting up the next day and like feeling okay to play the show in mind. If you have that one extra beer, you're like, all right, this show's gonna suck. I don't know, like, one of the things that we've always been really good about is eating well on tour in recent years. We always push pretty hard to, like, if there's catering, we try to have pretty solid catering, basic stuff that's not gross. And like, we don't get a whole lot of snacks or gross junk. It's just water and coffee and like some healthy shit. There's nothing worse than feeling terrible and playing a show. That's what I will, you know, it's that. You can't do it. You can't sustain. If you feel awful every day and have to go out there and rip a 2-hour set, it sucks. So you have to adapt, like, as your body changes and you get older. And I mean, yeah, there's a difference now than when I was 22. You know, I feel like we were invincible back then.
Unless you're Keith Richards, right?
Yeah, and then it's just like,
he's the anomaly.
The dude runs on heroin, I think, but hey.
Yeah.
You see that picture with everyone in the Rolling Stones has a Corona mask on except for Keith. He's like just hanging out. So
fuck yeah. That's amazing.
That dude's going to outlive us all, man.
There's a great picture of him next to Mick where Mick's on the treadmill. He brings a treadmill with him on tour, and Keith is sitting next to the treadmill smoking in a chair, right? Like they're just sitting there together.
I love it so much, man. It's very few and far between, but there's those people every now and then that just, I think at a certain point, their body just pickles, and it's like they become immortal from then on. Yeah.
No, I mean, it feels like your band, you guys have been the same guys since pretty much high school, right?
Yeah, we started in 2003. We started playing like covers of Anti-Flag in Ryan's basement. And then, yeah, 2006, we graduated, signed to Hopeless Records and got on the Warped Tour. And we've been doing it ever since.
Wow. Yeah, and it feels like, because I've had a couple members change and a couple of them leave and come back. It's like one of the guys in my band, this one time we were probably doing, you know, in the bus going like 80 down the freeway. And I woke up to the, you know, when you hit the bumps, when you're changing lanes in the bus and you're like, oh, is this the end? Is this the end? And then we were hitting the bumps for like probably 30 seconds. Like, and I'm like, fuck. And I look out and I see an ex-member of my band holding the bus driver's head as he's driving, just punching him on the side of his head. And I'm like, what are you doing? And I'm trying to pull him off. And it's like, it's so amazing to watch your band where I don't feel like you've had to deal with anyone in your band beating up the bus driver.
No, never. We've been fortunate in that none of our members have ever attacked the bus driver while driving. Holy shit. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like we've always been very cognizant of one another, and we've always treated this thing like, nobody was expendable and nobody was like, oh, well, you know, it's just so-and-so, like they don't really bring any value to this thing. So what they think doesn't matter. Like we've always been very, first of all, everybody does fucking matter in this band. Like it's without one member, we would not be All Time Low. That's something that we decided very, very early on. And two, like we're brothers. Like at the end of the day, you know, you fight with your family sometimes, and even when it's bad, you still acknowledge at the end of the day that it's like, okay, this is my family. Like it's not going to fall apart. We're going to figure out how to work through this. And I think everybody's always been given a voice and a platform when they've needed it. And I think that's always kept us pretty level and looking out for one another and trying to reach out and be like, hey, do you feel like you've been heard? Do you feel like your thought process has been understood in all of this? And I think that's just always kept us A, really close, and B, able to work through things, and C, just excited to be doing it. Like we're not doing it with any kind of like resentment for the guy stage right or stage left or whatever, you know. It's I think that's really valuable and really important. I've seen a lot of bands come and go through our time being a band, and you know, I think members dropping in and out, a lot of the time it is unfortunately lack of communication and like just feelings getting hurt and egos getting in the way of repairing those hurt feelings, you know. It's and that goes with, you know, that extends to life. That's not just a band thing, but it's hyper focused on us because the four of us have been doing business together, air quotes, for 16 years now.
All you guys are so fucking awesome. Your whole band, man, you are very, dudes. Yeah. I feel like you guys are a family. When I see you guys all together, it just feels like that, you know, because I'm sober and I made a choice to not drink. Sometimes for me, it's challenging. Have you ever had to deal with like any of that shit, like just addiction and.
I mean, in my personal life, yes. I mean, my half brother, struggled with alcoholism until he passed away, in his too young. I mean, nobody should pass away from alcoholism, but he was very, very young as well. So it's been pretty close to my life. Very fortunately, it has not affected the band. I think we've all had our moments where, you know, someone's partying a little too hard or going a little too far down the road of like, or just too much, you know, like the habitual drinking gets too easy. And I'm sure, you know, like when you're on tour, that shit's around all the time. You know, you get a rider every day and it's bottles of wine and liquor and beer and it's free, you know, and it becomes too easy sometimes. And you do every now and then have to check in with how you're doing. And is it becoming an unhealthy habit, or are you still able to kind of manage it and navigate it in a way that is not getting in the way of your life? And I think that's when it becomes problematic. And, you know, as you said, it's everybody's sort of on their own journey. And it's kind of like, for some people, they get to a point and it's time to bow out. Like I said, we've been fortunate that no one has kind of come into any sort of like real issues with any of that. And we were all pretty like, I'll be honest, like none of us have ever really been like into drugs or anything. Like we drink, smoke a little weed, but no one's ever been like, you know, going much further than that. And I think that's always been a good thing for us, is that, you know, nothing's ever come off the rails in that way. So we've been fortunate.
I didn't know that about your half brother, man. I'm really sorry. That's tragic.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it sucks, man. It was very sad and really tough on my family. But, you know, I was pretty young and I didn't, you know, I think it was very traumatizing at the time, but I also don't think I fully understood it. And that's something that I've kind of like come to terms with as I've gotten older and wrapped my head around it a bit more. But yeah, I mean, it's anyone that's going through it, whether it's themselves or whether it's someone close, it's a struggle for everybody involved. You know, because you hate to be seeing someone go through a struggle like that. And I know that's how it was for my family. So yeah, it's rough, but, he's, you know, I'm glad he's not hurting. That's all I would say now.
It changes the dynamic of the house, don't you think? Like how you were raised after that, it changes the dynamic in there with your mother and your father and everything kind of going on. And were they overly protective of you after that? Or how did that go for you?
I was very lucky in that my parents handled it really, really well. I mean, as best, you know, at least in regards to me, I don't know how well you can handle your child passing away, but
it's gotta be the worst thing there is, yeah, to go through. Yeah, there's nothing I can imagine that's worse. I have two children.
Absolutely not. No, but they did not let it interfere with my development. And I'm very grateful for that. They were always very sensitive to what I was thinking and feeling when I was thinking and feeling those things. They were always very encouraging of my goals and pursuits and how I wanted to think and feel my way through things. And whenever I wanted to talk about that kind of stuff, they were there and they were very open about it. And it was easy. It created a platform of like comfort where I was never like, I didn't feel like I had to shield myself from it, which I think oftentimes, you know, can lead to some, you know, darker mental places. So yeah, I was lucky.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's been times in my life when I was really dark and suicidal, especially in my teens. And you know, this is the amazing thing about music. I think music saved my life at that time. And I think a lot of people feel that way, that music saved their life. If you can find a band or certain songs that you connect to and you can feel like you're not alone with whatever it is you're feeling at that time. That's what I love about music, is it literally fucking saved my life. I you know, I wanted to kill myself and then I would put on certain songs and listen to them and it felt better. You know, it literally made me feel better.
I think it's
was it the Spice Girls?
Yes, it was the Spice Girls and Snoop Dogg. No.
If you want to be my lover, you got to get with my friends. Yeah.
It wasn't fucking Goldfinger, I'll tell you that.
Thanks, bro. Appreciate it.
Woo! Love it. I don't know. It's interesting, man. It's like, it's a universal language. And I think it's a voice for people that don't have someone to talk to. I think that's what's really interesting about music, is that it can be that like hand on your shoulder, as cheesy as that sounds. It's a comforting thing. Always has been. I mean, since time was time and music was music, I think it's always been a therapeutic thing for people.
Yeah. I work out to Slipknot. I cook to Coldplay. And I've got my regimen of what I like, music that I have throughout the day and what I listen to. It's amazing. You know, I listen to new music Friday when I'm driving. I mean, LA can be such a fucking gnarly, competitive, crazy place to be, you know, where I feel like I've got to, like, whatever. There's so many talented people here and so much to kind of do, and like sessions and all this shit. Like, should I be buying a farm in Maryland?
Yes.
If you...
I live in Bend, Oregon, and I love it.
Oh, there you go.
So, yeah.
Hell yeah. If you feel so inclined, I mean, I very much felt a calling to come back to Maryland and simplify a little bit and take a step back. I can only speak from personal experience, but LA just wasn't really for me. And I think it was because it put me in a mindset of unhealthy pressure on myself And you spoke to it a little bit, but that like sort of an unnecessary level of competition that I felt like wasn't really doing me any good. It was just unnecessary to think that way and to be in that mindset sometimes. And I find that here I am able to kind of rationalize those thoughts and feelings a little bit more and disconnect with them when I need to, which is also very good. You know, I can shift gears and kind of when I want to focus and buckle down and be creative and make the thing that I think is the shit for our next record, I can get in that frame of mind, but I can also much more easily remove myself from it and not feel like I'm losing a step on everyone around me, which I think is the grand illusion in Los Angeles, is that there's a lot of people, and I'm not saying this to talk shit, because I think it's also very inspiring to see everybody out there kind of pursuing their dreams. And I think it's amazing that that place, LA, cultivates that. But there is a lot of like, and I've seen it in friends and people I know, there is a lot of pressure to just always be doing. And like, what's the person in the apartment next door doing that I'm not doing? Do they have a more socially engaged TikTok than I do? Shit, I got to step it up. And it's like, it's such an unnecessary way of living, because I just think it eats away at you. At least it did for me. And so it was.
Are you doing TikTok?
We have a banned TikTok now because of the quarantine. We're just trying to find more and more ways to sort of engage. And all of us live all over the place, by the way. So I'm in Maryland, Jack's in LA, Zach is in Hawaii, excuse me. And our drummer Ryan is in Nashville. So we are all like, we're fucked. Like, we can't get together and record a song together for people. Like, we have to do everything remotely. So yeah, we are trying to understand TikTok, but I feel like this is the first time, honestly, that we have felt like generationally, we don't get something. Like, my band was always very on the edge of like when the online stuff started happening, like Pure Volume, MySpace, all those things. We were right in it. We got it right away. We were some of the first bands to have profiles on those things. And like those things were responsible for lifting us up as a band. And then we, you know, easy transition into Twitter, easy transition into Instagram. It all made sense. And TikTok is definitely the first one where we're all looking at each other like, I don't fucking get this. I don't get it.
I can pinpoint the moment in my life where I first felt old, and it was touring with Good Charlotte. And I grew up with bands where they, you know, concerts, people had lighters and they'd hold lighters yeah. up at the concert. And I walked out of the back with Good Charlotte and people were holding up phones. And that was the moment in my life where I first felt old, and I'll never forget it as long as I've been. Oh my God, this is an old person's moment. And
my daughter has like 120,000 TikTok followers. It's like, she is like got it wired, man. It's crazy. And she just knows, I mean, my daughter's 11. She knows when to post, how much to post, who to post with. It's like the whole thing. It's like a job. I mean, she really treats it like a job. She's like an entrepreneurial young lady, and it's great to watch. And then the other side of it is like, you're talking about the apartment next to you. Like, who's the guy next to you on their story? That's like, because I mean, the truth is that because my brain, my default brain sets to, it's never going to work out. I'm going to lose what I have, not get what I want. I've got like I go to sleep positive, and then I wake up with this negative voice that's like, it's not going to work out. So I have to constantly be saying, like, I say I love my life out loud, whether I mean it or I don't. I say it to take that contrary action. I jump in the pool that's 52 degrees, not because I'm like, I'm stoked to do it. I want to change my brain chemistry. You know, and sometimes I get on Instagram and I'm like, everyone, because we're not telling the truth 100% of the time that everything's always great, you know, but it's like when I say negative stuff, I feel negative and I don't want to do that to myself.
Well, it becomes a self-affirming cycle. You know, if you're feeling down and then you start playing into it, it's very hard to get out of it. And sometimes that is what it takes. It takes sort of insisting on the contrary, even if you don't necessarily feel that way, to at least begin to put a foot in the right direction. And that's kind of going back to the, you know, take a breath, it's just chemicals. That was literally that same sentiment right there. It was me. I didn't know if it was going to work. And obviously just breaking it down to saying, take a breath, it's just chemicals. That's a pretty big fucking oversimplification of everything. But at the same time, it can be a useful tool to just get yourself on the right path of trying to change the way you're feeling if you're feeling down.
I was lucky enough to meet Tony Robbins and go to his seminars and do his work. And that's what he calls a state change. You have an emotion, you're in an emotional state, which is depression or anger or whatever, and you can shift your state. And how do you shift your state? Whether you jump in the cold plunge or you take a breath or you start saying affirmations like John's talking about, I love my life, right? And you start to bring the emotion in when you say it. Because if you sit there and you go, I love my life, your brain goes, it's bullshit. Bullshit. Yeah. You have to actually get it in physically in your body to change it chemically in your brain. So you have to start to really go, I love my life. I love my life, which is how Feldy does it. So I'll have 100 people, 200 people in the room stand up on their feet and go, I love my life. I love my life, and scream and look up. And I go, look around the room after just saying that five times. Everyone's smiling. Everyone's in a different, I go, everyone's mood is just completely changed. Look at all the smiles on everyone's face. Just by saying that five times, I prove it in a room.
Absolutely. I think that's something that we still, I mean, I can barely speak to this from any place of knowledge, but, you know, I think that's something that we really misunderstand or still don't understand about the human psyche and how it corresponds to our body chemistry, brain chemistry, and our subconscious. You know, if that voice in your subconscious is the thing that's being negative and saying, I fucking hate my life, you know, screaming back at it can help. And it can, and it's all connected. I don't understand how it's connected fully, and I don't think anybody does yet. But there is absolutely a correlation between body, mind, subconscious, conscious, all of it. It's all connected.
No, but you know, to go back to the earlier talk where we were talking about LA, like, you know, I moved to Bend, Oregon 2 years ago now, and I was in LA for 23 years, and before that, I grew up in Boston for 23 years. And I felt that competition, that thing all the time, you know, not even being in the music business, but as a meditation, as a breathwork teacher, I felt that competition and that thing. And it was hard. Yeah. And it's a weird place. And to just see how some people live in such, I didn't want my kids to grow up with all that excess. I wanted them to have a more normal life in nature.
I mean, no one has this shit figured out. Nobody has life like wired. And it's like, you know, I think we're all just doing the best we can to figure it out. And, you know, and your wife is so incredible. I mean, Lisa's doing all right.
Yeah, she's doing great, man. I mean, both of us are pretty heavily affected by everything that's going on right now. My wife is an event planner. She does weddings and, you know, a lot of corporate nonprofit stuff. And so obviously all of that right now is on hold as well. So we're sort of both navigating this weird time together, essentially unemployed. And yeah, it's strange. It's really strange. But you know, what's great is that she also has an incredible head on her shoulders and is an extremely positive sounding board in my life. Somebody that I can, when I'm feeling strange and doubtful of my own shit, she is very good to sort of pull me back in the right direction and balance me out. And, we've known each other for so long, which also really helps. Like we're best friends first and foremost, you know? So it's like, that is always great that we can talk to one another, very openly and honestly in a way that's like, you know, there's just, she's my buddy, you know, it's funny to say, but like she's a friend. So.
Yeah. There's an author, Brené Brown, who's an amazing author. And she talks about everybody is literally doing the best they can. And,
yes.
And sometimes you want to go like, really, that's the fucking best you got. Like, that's really the best you get with certain people. And,
right.
But it is, I mean, I don't think people are purposely being shitty, but it feels that way sometimes because we're bumping up against our stuff with their stuff and it doesn't work out. Certain things don't work out, but everybody really is doing the best they can in every moment, you know? And if we can recognize that and go, you know what? It's like, this doesn't feel good, this interaction I'm having with this person, but they're doing the best they can. Like that might just shift the situation and in the dialogue and the discussion.
It's those ripping the Band-Aid off moments. You know, it's like, is this conversation going to be awkward and tough for the next hour? Maybe. Is it going to suck for a day while we navigate through what we've just talked about? Maybe. But is it ultimately going to lead to a much healthier, more beneficial place down the line? Absolutely. So it's like, and I think it's so hard to, when you're in it, sometimes it's so hard to see a week down the line or a month down the line or a year down the line when that stuff is all very much in the past and resolved in a good, healthy way. It's much easier to just be like, I'd rather not rip the Band-Aid off because it feels good now. But I think that's something that I've at least in more recent years really challenged myself to try and deal with and accept that those uncomfortable moments are necessary in kind of, you know, addressing things and having them play out the way you would want them to play out.
Well, before we let you go, man, how many animals do you have on this farm? Is he talking about the goats? Yeah. Like, what else you got out there?
Dude, we're all in, man. We have two horses. We got three goats, six chickens, and our two dogs. So that's where we're at right now. We're looking, I want to rescue a donkey. That's the next thing.
There you go.
What kind of dogs do you have?
We have a pit mix, and we have a little Papillon, a little fluffy guy.
So no, like, sheepdogs that are herding your goats or anything like that?
Well, we're going to find this out, but our pit mix is, so he's half, we had his DNA tested. He's like half Staffordshire Terrier, which is just what they call pit bulls, and half Australian cattle dog. So I think he's going to have a little bit of that, like, wanting to nip at their heels and get them to go places he wants them to go. We'll see. We haven't really put them together too much yet because the goats are fucking terrified of the dogs right now. But as they get a little bigger, we'll probably let them hang out and see what happens.
Nice. Well, dude, this is so fun, man. Dude, thank you so much, Alex. I love you, buddy.
Thanks for having me on, man. This is great. It's a really cool conversation.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Nice to see you, man. Thanks, John. Yeah. Honestly, dude, I don't often get to have extensive conversations like this, because a lot of the time when I do podcasts or interviews or anything, it's mostly centered around my band and the music. So it's pretty cool to have a talk with some good dudes about some other shit. So thank you.
Thank you, man. Yeah.